Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, your sorry so-and-sos, you got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government?
Jerry, are you muted?
You know what? I did. Welcome to Handling the Truth. I'll repeat what I just said that nobody heard. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here tonight with my co-host, the Rebel Madman himself, Mike Getty. And we've got a really extra special show tonight. I'm going to let Mike introduce our very special guest tonight. And this is, you know, some of my favorite shows here at Handling the Truth are the ones where I don't have to say a whole lot, and I can sit back and learn and enjoy the discussion without having to think about it. I just sit back and learn myself, and that's kind of the way I think it's going to go tonight. So say hello, Mike.
Hello, Mike.
Thanks for getting me off mute. Totally. I hit the mute button and didn't even think about it after that.
You're usually pretty prompt with that.
let's open this right with a prayer, gentlemen. El Shaddai, Almighty God in heaven, our Father, our Creator, where would we be without you? Because we know that you sustain everything. You sustain us, and you're the only one that can sustain us eternally. Father, we always invite your spirit to be with us at this show, on this broadcast, and no different tonight. We know that we need you. We acknowledge that we need you desperately, particularly in this world, this empire of lies that we live in. And we want you to take control. We open the door to you willingly to take control. We know that that your plan is so much better than our own, and we know that your timing is perfect, and sometimes we're very impatient with that. But we know that we can turn to you no matter what, and that we can rely on you to be the final victor of this battle that's going on and raging. So fill us with your spirit. Fill our listeners with your spirit. Fill our guest with your spirit, please. It's in the name of your Son, our Savior, our King, Yahshua HaMashiach, we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, I'll just get out of the way and let you invite our very special guest.
All right. Thank you, Terry. This is I've kind of liked this guy for quite a while. It happens to be my son, Christopher Getty, and I'm very proud of this young man. Have been for many years now. He at an early age, I think it was 11, he made the choice of where he wanted to go to college. And he told his mother and I that he was going, as a matter of fact, we were parked at the time. We had been on a vacation, and we had visited Washington and Lee University, and right across the street we had visited VMI. We had been in the museums of both and gone into the chapel where Robert E. Lee is interred. And we came back out, and our son got into the back seat of the car, and he said, "This is where I'm going to school. This is where I'm going to college." So we had to ask him which one, and he said VMI. And he never took his sights off of doing exactly that. And So he graduated in the year 2001. And so we're going to talk tonight about how that Virginia Military Institute, the West Point of the South, as it is known, has come under heavy fire and criticism because of its Southern roots. Chris, say hello to the folks and tell them a little bit about yourself, please.
Hello, everybody. As you said, Pop, I, you know, being my graduate, currently work in the firearms industry out in the Iowa, Illinois area. I graduated in 2001, got commissioned in the Army, served in the Army until 2006, and have been working in the private sector since then. Married, got two wonderful daughters, and, you know, just kind of enjoying life as much as I can.
Give folks a little bit of an idea about what it's like to be a rat at VMI, as you were, son.
Well, it was a very unpleasant time to be in college. I can tell you that much. Usually, you start off with what they call Hell Week, which is about a week before actual classes start. They bring in the rat mass, or all the freshmen, and it's basically a nonstop indoctrination, so to speak, into VMI. They use that week to break you down so they can rebuild you up as a VMI cadet. You learn all the, I guess you want to say, institute doctrine that there is to learn during that week. It's gets pounded in your head. Like, I can remember hours upon hours of just yelling, like, the honor code or the Newmarket cadets into the wall while we waited in between training sessions or being issued our clothing and our equipment and so forth. But the one thing that they hammered into your head constantly that whole week was the honor code, which is a cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those that do. And when I went through, attrition was the mission, so to speak. I think we started off with 30 some cadets in my company, and I think by the end of that week we were down to around 20. And that was pretty much the standard back then during Hell Week, was to try to run off as many cadets as, well, rats as possible. And to survive that was one thing, and then you went right into the rat line, which lasted usually until the end of February, March time frame. Ours lasted longer because one of the things they encourage rats to do is show unity and occasional rat riot. And we did a little bit of damage, so our rat line got extended. But during the rat line, you have one privilege, and that's the strain, which is the exaggerated position of attention. When you're in barracks, that's all you do. When you eat, that's how you eat. You're only allowed to walk a certain line in the barracks. In fact, that line has been walked so much that the concrete is worn where the rats have squared their corners going around the different stairs in Sallyports, as well as where they pounded the steps going up to the fourth floor. And And even getting up to the fourth floor was always a challenge because upperclassmen could stop you and ask you rat knowledge and work you out. Upperclassmen had a bad day. Well, you had a bad day too, because you got stopped on the stoop. You could be there for 30 minutes getting worked out. It was not a pleasant, first semester, or, you know, most of second semester for us in college. Unlike most college freshmen, we didn't spend our time partying. It was getting worked out with sweat parties at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was constant physical activity. And on top of that, you had a full class load that you had to balance with that. And once you were out of the rat line, it didn't stop there. You had the academic rat line is what they call it afterwards. Excuse me. VMI is a very intense education, small classes, maybe 10, 20 tops in a class. And if it was 20, it was probably a lecture. And you had a full load on top of all your military duties that you had to do day in and day out. So you're up at 7. We usually, TAPS was at 11, but you were usually studying to 2 o'clock in the morning. And then if you had military obligations, such as Army ROTC, you'd be up for PT 3 days a week at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it kind of maintained that pace through 4 years. But the whole time, one of the guiding principles was the honor code and honor and taking personal responsibility and you know, just like doing like the code said, not lying, cheating, or stealing or tolerating those who do. Some of the examples, like you would have to sign out on a permit to go to leave post. So there was one permit to sign out to go to church. You were only authorized to leave post, go to church, and come back. You could not deviate for any reason. If you did, you were obligated to turn yourself in, which is they called boning yourself. Getting a bone was getting a demerit or getting a special, so to speak. And penalties ranged from room confinement all the way to just demerits. And room confinement was even served on the honor system. You had 5 checks, and you had to be in an all right spot during those 5 checks. And if you weren't, you had to turn yourself in. You were honor bound to be doing the right thing at the right time, all the time. And that also included turning those in who weren't. You know, you could get rolled out, drummed out for knowing that somebody violated the honor code and not doing your duty and turning them in for doing so. And, you know, once you were convicted of an honor code violation, you were basically run out of the school. You were erased from all documents. Your existence was never there. I remember there was a committee member, I think it was my junior year, that got drummed out of school and for an honor code violation. And somebody went through every academic building, every room in barracks. It took a black magic marker and went through his name on all the committee posters. And that's how serious they took it. And a drum out occurred about 3 o'clock in the morning. You'd hear the drums rolling in the sally port. They've since added another barrack section, but there used to be 2 barracks, old barracks and new barracks. And there was a sally port in between, and the drummers would drum in the sally port, and it would wake up the entire barracks, and everybody would come out to old barracks courtyard, and the honor code would come out, announce the cadet's name, say that he put personal gain over honor, and that his name shall never be spoke within the four walls again. And then that was it. He went back to bed and never spoke of that guy again. Even, you know, it was somewhat taboo even to speak a person's name that got rolled out. You always referred to him as that guy or the guy that they got rolled last week or whatever. It was, you know, that's how, you know, how closely we held that honor code to just our daily lives. In fact, I know alumni now you know, all of us still try to live by that code as much as possible. I have a good friend who runs a company, and he actually got a copy of the honor code with all the explanations and rules and how things worked from our rat year that hung in our room. And he blew it up into big poster size, and it's in his office at the company that he runs. I mean, that's how much we just live by the code. It was hammered into us. We lived by it like strictly for 4 years, and it's carried on with us, and it's now under attack, unfortunately.
Well, what
apparently honor is not a. Go ahead, sorry.
Well, that's okay. Finish up, please.
Well, like I said, it's under attack now because apparently living honorably is not something that is fashionable.
Well, that is for sure. I was just going to ask you, with all of that experience and the things you went through, how would you say that has impacted your life?
It's impacted my life greatly. It taught life lessons. It taught me, how to do the right thing, no matter how hard or difficult it was going to be. It taught me to accept, the punishment for doing something wrong. You know, that was one thing that, it's hard to be mischievous and kind of bend the rules or break the rules when you got to do it honorably. So you learned real quick that if you're going to, say, run the block, which was leave campus without permission, and you got caught or you missed a check, you turned yourself in and you accepted the responsibilities of your actions. And, that was something you instilled in me, and in VMI, reinforced that accepting the consequences for your actions and, living like that. Now, that carries with me even today. In fact, I find it amazing when I do something wrong, say I mess something up at work or drop the ball on something, and going to my boss and admitting that I did it and going, let me fix this. I did wrong. I messed this up, blah, blah, blah. It, in the corporate world, it's amazingly how shocked people get when you do that, because apparently owning up to your mistakes and accepting the consequences for your actions is, again, something that has become unfashionable.
Oh, well, I'm sure we have to get rid of that nasty habit in this country. We can't have people actually standing up for what they do and admitting they might have done something wrong. Must be why very few BMI people ever end up running for public office.
Well, y'all, exactly.
Well, just to, and I know we have mentioned this on another program that you appeared with me on, but this is a different audience, and I did want to bring up this. At your matriculation in 1997, kind of describe what happened, and you can include what the deal I made with Joey Bates if you want to.
So we matriculated, and it's kind of a time-honored tradition of when the rats come in, they sign the matriculation book, they get assigned to a company, and then they get whisked away from their parents, and then Hell Week starts shortly afterwards. It's varied from year to year. Sometimes it starts right then. Sometimes you got a day kind of buffer in between. But that's the start of Hell Week. And I think, if I remember correctly, you found my XO and basically gave him permission to do whatever the heck he wanted to and made sure he kicked my butt every chance he got.
Well,
which at the end
of
Hell Week, he did remind me. Tell you that.
As a matter of fact, I made him an offer. I offered Joey Bates $100 if he could run your ass off.
Well, he tried. He tried to earn that $100. I'll give him that much.
Well, your dad was looking out for you, son.
Well, yes, sir. And like I said, go ahead.
He had you doing push-ups on the bus to New Market Battlefield, didn't he?
Yep. On the way back, he had me doing push-ups in the bus aisle and instructed me to let you know that he was doing what you said and trying to earn that $100. But you look back, it was good times.
Yeah, I really like Joey Bates. He was a heck of a guy. But I think we've set a preface here, son, so that people could understand what VMI was about. And I know when you were there, every meal, cadets were required to go to all the meals, right?
That's right. You were required to march down after, reveille or taps, and after accountability was taken, the whole corps would march down. The only people that didn't have to were first classmen. As a rat, you were required to attend every meal with cadre, so breakfast and dinner. You had meals with cadre, which usually consisted of sitting on the edge of your seat, probably about 3 inches on the edge of your seat at the position of attention, and you would eat what they call square meals. For months, I never saw what my food looked like for breakfast or dinner. Knowing Crozet, that was probably a good thing, but you would have to sit there in what they call square meals. So you would spoon food on your utensil. You'd bring it up, and then you'd go 90 degrees in your mouth, put it down, chew. And if you wanted food, because it was always family style, you'd have to, sound off with Brother Rat, please pass me the potatoes, or Brother Rat, please pass me this or that. And there were certain foods you stayed away from, like you never asked for the shelf-stable milk, because then that was usually, if you had the more I wouldn't call them sadistic, but the more creative cadre would make you chug it. And butter. You never asked for butter because you usually were made to eat the whole stick of butter. So there was things you kind of stayed away from on the table. But also during that meal, you had to maintain military bearing and answer questions that the cadre would ask you. And it was from rat knowledge out of your rat Bible, which was basically, facts about BMI, all the committee members, new market questions, code of the cadet, the parapet, what's inscribed on the parapet, and just general knowledge about the school. And if you didn't answer correctly, then life just got really hard for you. So everything was kind of tough, the best way to put it. Like you were constantly under stress and learning to adapt and work in that and operate in that type of environment.
It is a very good description, son, and I really thank you for that. When you were there, the beginnings of the attack by what I refer to as the cultural Marxist had already begun. And of course, you had the introduction of females into an all-male school, even though there was an all-female school right up the road in Stanton, wasn't there?
Correct, yes. And you're right, that was kind of the beginning of the end for VMI, its tradition and its ways, because it kind of opened the door for the outside world to come take a close look at what goes on at VMI. And I know it's probably not politically correct to say something like this, but when you take an institution like VMI that's been all male, that's had its traditions and everything, and you force it open to the world, and then you introduce the female element, there's no way to be able to maintain those traditions, those ways of doing things. Because as we've seen, when you do that, physically standards have to change. You can no longer have one core, one standard. It's usually one core, two standards, which we saw right off the bat with the introduction of the female cadets. And then being open to the public, we used to always say the VMI world, VMI is a bubble. And outside that bubble, it's a whole other planet. And inside that bubble, it's completely different from outside. And you can't take what's inside that bubble and make it make sense to people who live outside of it. And once you open that and you let the outside world in, there are things they don't understand. There's things people they think are archaic. And we saw it steadily kind of erode standards. Even my first class year or my senior year, we saw things changing from how breakfast and dinners were conducted. No longer was it just huge shouting matches of cadre yelling at you while you were trying to eat and asking you questions. Being able to work rats out at random on the stoop kind of was being heavily regulated. Even how first classmen and the rats, and I forgot to kind of touch on this earlier, but when you're a rat, you get what they call a dyke or a first class mentor. And his job is to teach you all the ins and outs of VMI, the stuff the cadre doesn't teach you, you know, how to answer a special, how to fill out a permit, you know, how to pick up your laundry. And in turn, you would do things for your dyke. You would clean his room, pick up his laundry. They would run rat missions. So you go do stupid pranks on other first classmen and whatnot. It was all fun and games. And even when I became a first classman, we saw what was done to us as rats not allowed, like cleaning the room. Now, we didn't pay much attention to those rules. We made our rats clean our room, and sometimes we got caught, sometimes we didn't doing it. Funny story is when we went on the march to Newmarket, we left instructions for our rats to put up our racks, haze, and clean the room, and the last instruction was destroy the note. And during the inspection, the inspecting officer saw the note instructing our rats to do all our cleaning. And well, we got boned for it. I forgot what the penalty was exactly, but when we went to answer the special to the deputy commandant, Colonel Levinson, he actually laughed at us and said, "Well, I guess your rats aren't as smart as you think they are because they failed to follow the last instruction, which was destroy the note."
Briefly explain to the people who are listening the importance of that march to Newmarket you did, and tell people how far that is.
Okay. So every year, I don't know if they do it now, but they did it while I was a cadet. First classmen take the hat brass or the unit crest for the rat class. Rats don't get them until they go to Newmarket and learn about the battle and do their charge across the field, and it's usually the culminating of Hell Week. But first classmen would reenact the march from Lexington to Newmarket, Virginia, which is 86.5 miles. And my senior year, me and about eight other first classmen, we loaded up, put all the rats' hat brass in our rucksack, and we marched 86.5 miles. It took us about 3 days to hike that far, and we would sleep on the side of the road. We took breaks, and then we arrived on the day that the rat class made it to Newmarket, and they were busting. And what they would do is they would go and learn about the battle. They would walk around and have tours. They would have reenactors there telling them about the battle, walking them through all the stages that the cadets went through. And, you know, this kind of started back in barracks with the rats being taught, you know, when VMI got called up, the march up to Newmarket. Then they went to Newmarket and they learned, you know, the order of battle, when the cadets were moved up, and they were walked past the Bush Arm House, and they went to the fence line, and then they were told at this point is when they gave the charge, and they would go over the fence line. And after all the rats went through and learned all that history, went through the museum and got the tour, they would line up as the cadets did in 1864 on the backside of the fence along the Bushong farm. And then they would start at a march all in line, like a traditional battle formation during that time. And then they would get to a certain point and the order of charge would be given, and they would charge across the field to the cadet battery, which was put at the top where the Union battery was, as the cadet battery was firing blank 105 shells. And it was all about teaching the history of VMI, the sacrifices of the Newmarket cadets, which we, you know, it's something that every rat, that sense of history, that sense of brothership, you know, sacrifice and everything is just hammered in to you from day one. And, you know, it's not, and despite what they say, it was never portrayed as the Civil War, North versus South, who was right, who was wrong, what was all that, like they like to say it is. It was all about the cadets. It was all about their sacrifice, what they endured, and the lasting legacy that a lot of those cadets who survived the battle, 10 were killed, 6 of which are buried on campus, did for the state of Virginia. A lot of them went on and served VMI, served the state of Virginia and the United States in some capacity, and went on and did great things. And that's what the lesson was. And that was given, and that was trying to give, they try to give those, the rats, the, that sense of belonging, that sense of history, the tradition and that honor that, you know, by using the Newmarket cadets as examples of that. And that's why they charge across the field. You know, it's all about, you know, being part of something bigger than you, which VMI is when you're a cadet.
Well, if I remember correctly, one of those cadets that lost their life in that charging across that field of lost shoes, last name was Jefferson. And if I'm not mistaken, he was Thomas Jefferson's great nephew. Is that not correct?
I think so. I think you're correct. Yes, sir.
So anyway, now we've established what VMI is about. And now VMI, of course, it started with the women. And then it was said that no Confederate battle flags could be at VMI. Although I remember visiting you one time and I did something very nasty. I went out and put little Confederate battle flags on all of the graves of the VMI cadets that was buried there on campus. Of course, the campus police removed them within a few hours, I'm sure, but at least they were there for a little while. So the rebel madman is known to do such things as that. But, you know, and I felt like an honor to do that. I didn't ask you to accompany me. I didn't want you in trouble. But just before we really get into the full force attack that is coming now, tell the folks a little bit about your junior year or your second class year, and when you got a group together and you guys went down to the cemetery in Lexington to honor a veteran, a Civil War veteran.
I think that was my first class year, Pop, because we were, because remember our junior year and we played Dixie at the Newmarket ceremony, we got basically threatened our first class year with expulsion and not being able to graduate if we did it again. So we did research, and I'm drawing a blank on the gentleman's name.
Levi
Miller, yes, sir. We went down and put a permit together to go down and place a battle flag and do a little memorial ceremony, just the first classman in the pipe band, at his gravesite, which was a Confederate marker given to those that were awarded, you know, that served in the Confederate Army. The interesting thing about Mr. Miller was that it was an all-black cemetery, and he was a black gentleman. Who served in the Confederate Army and was awarded a Confederate pension at the end of the war, which to the dismay and shock of our sergeant major, he was not aware that such things existed. And they did put an article in the newspaper about it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, they did. I remember that. And, of course, your rambunctious father wrote an article about that, and they actually put it in the cadet newspaper, did they not?
They did. And interesting, if you go to the VMI archives and search, you can pull up that article in cadet newspaper edition. It's on the archives at the VMI library.
Wow, I feel honored that something I wrote is in the archives at VMI. All right, now let's jump into what has happened and give the folks kind of a brief rundown on what happened in the late summer of this past year about the governor of Virginia and what kind of demands he made on VMI.
Well, it started off with an article by a Washington Post writer who kind of has a history of going after VMI for one thing or another. And he, together with a bunch of former cadets, wrote an article about what was perceived as institutional racism at VMI, and stemming from the they were citing being forced to endure Civil War history, and you know, having to pay homage to the likes of Stonewall Jackson, and how they were subject to racist comments and statements from faculty and cadets, and how that they were mistreated or not given certain things because of race. And it was several former cadets, and it kind of started the ball rolling with the governor of Virginia. After that, he started shortly after that article came out, and some follow-up articles revolving around the same thing. He ordered a investigation into VMI to weed out the racists and to fix the institutional racism that is VMI. He pressured them to the point of where the current superintendent resigned, General P, and they started this huge, I can't think of what they call it now, I want to say cultural sensitivity, but I don't think that's the term they use, training and in along with this investigation. And since those articles have come out, they have removed Stonewall Jackson. They did that over Christmas break. They have formed committees with the Alumni Association, excuse me, after they were trained on institutional racism and what it means to be a minority in America and whatnot. They are now exploring renaming all the buildings if they have any connection with slavery or whoever 100 years ago might have said something racist, so they can be more culturally sensitive. In fact, you can find that report on the Board of Visitors meeting notes, where they go through and designate all the buildings that have racist people named after them. And then they hired a law firm out of Indiana to conduct an investigation into the culture of racism at VMI. And then I want to say back in early January, that same Washington Post reporter did another article using a former football player cadet who was drummed out of VMI for honor code violations. He wrote an article about how he was convicted of cheating. And that was because it was racism that did it. He was convicted by a bunch of, you know, white honor court members. He was singled out because he was black, and how that also tied into another incident where he said that a member of cadre, when he was a rat, said something racist to him. From what I could tell from that article, it was more of a he said, she said type incident. But as we know with the times, the accuser is never wrong. The accusee was found guilty and actually left VMI. And it kind of ruined his career there. He never came back. So that started the attack on the honor code and the honor court and how they proceed with enforcing the honor code as being systematically a racist system, because they stated things like minorities are disproportionately drummed out, the non-minorities, you know, how that the normal justification for that type of accusation goes. And I found it interesting about that article and the cadet that he was using as an example, because even in the article, it stated that before he even went to VMI, there was questions about him cheating on the SATs. In fact, the football NCAA and the football team had to like waive that. And again, race claims of racism that the SAT was racist is the reason why they waived it and allowed him to go to VMI in the first place. So he already went in there with the case of cheating looming over his head. And as the story goes, a teacher was suspecting him of cheating and placed a member of the honor court or a agent of the honor court, which isn't unheard of. It wasn't unheard of when we were cadets, that you have the little, we called them spooks. They would kind of be little enforcers of the honor court, honor code. But they had a plant in there, and during the test, he literally sat and watched him cheat off of another cadet. And the teacher rigged the test so it would be more of a concrete, okay, you cheated, definitely. And it was a pretty open and shut case. But again, claims of racism and whatnot were being thrown around in that article. I went online, actually, and on one of the boards, VMI boards, I think it was an alumni board on Facebook, and they had his former, some of his classmates, some of his cadre, and one of his former teammates. And I think the statement by his former teammate was the most damning, when they said that he was surprised he lasted as long as he did at VMI, because the guy had a problem with honesty and had a problem with following the honor code. Like, they thought he'd have been gone a lot sooner than he was. So they take, again, an example of how we've created this culture of if you do something wrong, it's not your fault. It is, the person who caught you doing something wrong is racist, and, you know, it's not your fault type deal. And that culture is now the reason why VMI is under investigation, and the honor code and system in itself is under threat because of claims of, which I think now has just been weaponized to be able to destroy institutions like VMI and systems like the honor code as being racist.
Well, gosh, son, you know that being honest is racist.
I've been told that, yes.
So, shouldn't we throw in here that a black man on the Supreme Court actually sent his son to VMI?
That's Clarence Thomas. His son was in my Dykes class. You remember?
Yeah.
You actually met Justice Thomas at the PX.
It was June Hall, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was June Hall.
Yeah. So, I haven't heard Clarence Thomas or his son say anything about VMI being racist, have you?
No. You know, most of the loudest ones and the ones that have come forward with these claims are the younger generation cadets. Most, if not all, have been athletes. And I think, as we talked on the other program, athletes at VMI are kind of outsiders within that culture. And a lot of them are looked upon as highly, I would say, or regarded highly because of the fact that, I'm not saying all, there are a lot of good athletes who go to VMI for the right reasons, and they, you know, they're there to be, to participate in the military aspect as well as the scholastic and sports aspect of VMI. But there are those that go there because they can't go to a norm, they didn't make it into a big time school. They get sent there on a scholarship. They are a lot of times not told or fully understand what they're getting themselves into. And all they want to do is play sports. They don't want to participate in the rat line. They don't want to participate at all in anything other than playing sports, going to class, and that's it. And it causes this divide amongst cadets and athletes. And, you know, like I said, there are some really good cadets that are NCAA athletes, but as a whole, they're not. They want special treatment. They want to be, they want that, you know, NCAA athlete treatment that you would get at a normal school at VMI, and it just doesn't work that way. And football players, in my experience, football players were the worst. You know, they got almost out of the rat line completely because the majority of the rat line was during football season. A lot of them got there on full ride scholarships because they couldn't go to a normal, like a big time NCAA football school. They weren't that good of a football player. And they really did not want to be there and participate in anything but playing football and trying to go to class. And on top of that, you're forced to, as a cadet, to go watch these football games, which wouldn't be bad if they actually won a game once in a blue moon. You know, for instance, 4 years I went there, I think they won four games, and two of which were in the same year. So there's this rift, and you see that with these cadets that have come forward and were like they're athletes. They talk about how, you know, they weren't treated right. Well, yeah, that's just kind of how it goes. It wasn't because of racism. It was because of you went to a school that was all about camaraderie, brother rats, unity, the military aspect, overcoming adversity, and you didn't want to have anything to do with it. You know, one thing that they taught you were that if you come upon your brother rat on the stoop doing having to do push-ups or getting yelled at, you didn't leave him. You stayed there, and you pushed when he pushed. As a lad, I remember standing for 10 minutes next to a brother rat who was getting yelled at and worked out. I got worked out in tune because every time he dropped, I dropped. And, you know, that's what was taught. And one of the biggest disrespects that you could give to a rat, say one who wasn't pulling his own weight or that didn't want to participate, was to come upon him on the stoop like that and leave him. You know, and you were tested all the time to leave your brother rat or to do this or do that. And it was all about unity. And when you don't want to participate in that, there's a natural divide that occurs. And that's what you see. And why I'm not surprised that all these allegations and all this stuff is becoming from former athletes. And a lot of them didn't even make it all the way through the 4 years at VMI. And then you do have some of your older alumnus, and I like to call it bandwagon guys that like to jump on with them in a show of support or solidarity. And I don't know if it's just because of need to what weird need to, but all of a sudden, 20 years after you graduate VMI, all of a sudden it was this big, bad, racist place. And you just now want to tell the world about it because I guess it's the cool thing to do in today's society. But I lost my train of thought. Sorry about that.
Well, that's you get that. That's hereditary. You get it from your dad.
But yeah, it you see that, and then you go back and you see the cadets, some of the first black cadets that went to VMI in the late 60s, early 70s. And I've seen articles that these guys have put out and statements these guys have put out that were like, I don't know what you're talking about. These were the first black cadets after VMI was, I guess you can say, desegregated, that went to a school that was supposedly this bastion of racism, that not only didn't see that while they were there, but were treated just like every other cadet and were successful at VMI and after. You know, the 80s, all these older cadets are going, I don't see it, I don't get it. And it, you know, apparently somewhere in the early 2000s, VMI just went racist, apparently. And again, it's the weaponized idea of racism that is now being used to destroy a bastion of ideals that are contrary and to what the government and what society now thinks is right. It's the only thing I can think of at this point.
Son, that's great. I, you know, just to go in to give people kind of an inside look of what it was like at VMI and what it meant to actually that day that you graduated. How important was it to you to have survived 4 years at VMI?
It was extremely important. I still take great pride in the fact that I graduated from VMI. It wasn't easy. You know, I could have not gone to school, or I could have gone to a normal college. Granted, I don't think I would have been as successful or even graduated from a normal college because, you know, I needed a little discipline. I needed a lot of discipline. But it was a great sense of pride. It was an accomplishment. You know, it was something you can go and look at and say, and not many people can do that and say, I survived 4 years at VMI. I'm part of this institution. I'm part of this tradition, and I'm part of this culture of men and now ladies that have survived 4 years of the toughest academic and military school, I would say, in the country. I mean, West Pointers can't even say that.
Well, you know, I think one of the greatest accolades that I can think of in history was a comment from the great George Patton, when Patton said, give me a battalion of Citadel cadets and I will win you a battle. Give me a regiment of VMI cadets and I'll win you a damn war.
Yeah. And
crazy. Doesn't come much higher than that from old blood and guts, who was not known for praising people too loudly.
Correct. And, you know, that was, and to that point, throughout my career in the military, and even now, being a VMI graduate carried a lot more weight and a lot more expectations with it. You know, I never once heard a story about a bad VMI leader. I heard tons of them about bad West Point leaders, but I never heard an NCO, another officer, or anybody that had served with a VMI graduate say that was the worst leader I ever had. You know, we always did well in all of our trainings. I remember going through what they called at the time advanced camp. They've changed it since then, through ROTC. And once the instructors found out that you were a VMI cadet, you were held to a higher standard than everybody. And it was hardly ever that you didn't live up to that standard or exceed that standard. It was just an expectation set. It came with a, you know, graduating from them comes with a reputation and an expectation, I guess, when you're a VMI graduate. And people see that. You know, probably why we have such big class rings.
Right. Well, son, that, you know, thanks so much for that. I think it gives people an insight, gives them a side of this racism claim. And, of course, they took down the statue of Stonewall Jackson during Christmas break so as to make sure there were no cadets there to protest it, because they sure as hell didn't want that in the news, that the cadets themselves stood for Thomas Jonathan Jackson, a man who never owned a slave and who broke the law to teach blacks to read in Lexington, Virginia, right down there from the campus, right?
Right, correct. And I find it highly ironic that they got rid of his statue, but when you walk into the through the main arch, which is Jackson Arch, right above you as you walk in is a quote from Stonewall Jackson. It says, "You may be whatever you resolve to be," which, again, is a very poignant statement and a idea or a code that is ingrained in you as a cadet and you live up to, because, you know, at the end of 4 years, you know you can do anything you put your mind to. You can be anything you want to. And I think VMI graduates have demonstrated that over and over again.
Okay. Well, you know, now let's kind of branch off a little bit. And that you've covered that very well, son. I really appreciate that. Let's branch off a little bit now to the new Secretary of Defense, the new SecDef, and his mission to eliminate white supremacists in the United States military. And you still have some connection with some folks you served with, both in Iraq and Korea. Tell me what you're hearing from those folks about what's happening in the military now.
I think I mentioned to you the other day, I looked at my old unit, 214 CAV, which is now part of 25th ID in Hawaii. They took a whole 2 days for multicultural training, and they were doing multicultural exercises to illustrate how racism is and to help understand other cultures better. And, you know, it was all civilian clothes and it was all, you know, touchy-feely, lovey-dovey stuff. And, you know, I've talked to some guys I still know that are in there, and they're dreading this whole thing because it's the beginning of the end of good order and discipline in the military.
Well, go ahead.
Well, when the private figures out that he can do whatever he wants, he doesn't have to follow orders, he doesn't have to listen, and if you make him, well, you're a racist. How can you maintain order and discipline in the military? How can you build unit cohesion when, you know, everybody's looking at everybody else going, well, that guy's a racist. I don't got to do anything because if you make me do something, that's racist. Or, you know, what, I mean, it's just going to, and it'll destroy morale because you'll have one group of soldiers that are being held to a standard and have to maintain that standard while another group doesn't have to. And that's going to affect training. That's going to affect discipline, morale, the whole nine yards. And you're going to take these groups of people into combat. Probably by that time, they'll be fighting each other more so than they'll be fighting the enemy. They won't trust each other. You won't have unit cohesion. It's going to be a disaster.
Well, I can't argue that point, son. And then not only that, but we're going to now, as taxpayers in the military, we're going to be paying to change the gender of soldiers as well.
Oh man, it's you're wondering when you're going to wake up and exit the Twilight Zone when you hear stuff like that. Like it is, if it wasn't real, I would like think you're out of your mind, Pop, when you say stuff like that. But again, they're turning the military into this big social experiment. And I don't understand how you're going to effectively maintain a fighting force. Because I guarantee you, ISIS doesn't care what color you are. They don't probably even know what what the word racist is or racism is. And they don't care. And the fact is that we're too busy trying to make, and they definitely don't care about your feelings. So now we're going to take a bunch of, you know, lovey-dovey soldiers who, you know, don't have to do anything because if you make him, that's racist. Fight a group of guys who literally put weapons together from scrap and will, you know, come at you in a pair of sandals and an Adidas tracksuit. Like, how in a million years can anybody at that level go, yeah, that's a great idea? I just can't fathom it. It's absolutely ludicrous to me.
Well, it's decadence, son, at the highest level, and it comes as a society deteriorates. It's historical. You are a historian yourself, and you know that's correct. We're swirling down the cesspool of history here, and unfortunately, we have to watch it, those of us who don't agree with it.
You know, because hey, you know, in most Americans, as long as you got your Facebook and your, you know, your Netflix, it's all going to be okay. Because I don't have to deal with it. And what was that movie about? Was it Gladiator? That scene in Gladiator when they were talking about how the government and the new emperor was corrupt and all these things, and I think one of the senators said to the other, "But we've got the games. Rome could fall around them. As long as they have the games, no one cares."
Well, and we can go to the quote of Emma Goldman when she said, "Americans do not want to be free. They want to be comfortable."
That's a very true statement.
And I don't believe you can be comfortable and free for very long.
No, because to be comfortable, yeah, I mean, you can't. You know, uncomfortable freedom to me is way better than comfortable.
Son, as you're talking to your fellow cadets and graduates of BMI, what is the overall sense? Are they what are they saying? What are they feeling?
I would say it's a mixed. You know, we talked about the bandwagon guys. And then I got you have the other group that's I hate to use the term, but I call them Kool-Aid drinkers, that they believe everything's going to work out. This is good for the eye. It'll survive the storm. You know, maybe we do need to kind of modernize with the times and kind of drop some of the old ways and traditions. You know, we're all Virginia Mill. We're all, you know, we'll always be strong. And you've got those like myself who are saddened and disgusted by the whole thing and really just kind of slowly moved farther and farther and farther away from it all. It's not that we're ashamed to be BMI graduates. We're just saddened by what the school has become and what people have allowed it to become. You know, you've got your loudmouths that run their mouth, but when it push comes to shove, they're not going to step up to the plate and do anything about it. And as you well know, you know, one or two guys fighting something this big is never going to be effective because you'll get labeled a kook and a crazy and whatever and dismissed. And unfortunately, VMI guys are independent to the point that I don't think you get a large enough group of everybody together to really make a difference. And I think at this point, most of us have just kind of, you know, think it's just going to be too little too late at this point.
Well, son, you know, I remember your first clash here when you guys who were in the piping drum corps were threatened with being kicked out of school if you played Dixie. And, you know, I still get chilled when I remember the VMI marching by the monument of Virginia Mourns Her Dead, and when that pipe and drum corps would break into Dixie on the bagpipes. Man, I tell you what, I still get chills thinking about that. But, you know, right across the street, and most people aren't aware of this if they aren't aware of the geography, right across the street is Washington and Lee University. And there is a major campaign now to remove Robert E. Lee's name from that school. And, you know, I don't know what they're going to do with it. And I wanted your thoughts on this. I fear that what this is the beginning of the eventually they're going to say they have to do away with VMI altogether.
I think you're right. I do think this is the beginning of the end of VMI. And even you called it back in 2001. You wrote an article about it and called it. And I think what we're seeing, and we're reaping the rewards for complacency at this point. You called it back in the early 2000s. Heck, we probably saw the start of it in the mid to late 90s. And they, you know, they completely rice bowled us. They've taken a little grain of rice away from us every year, a little bit here, a little bit there. And now we're to the point where we've got an empty bowl and there's nothing we can do about it. Especially in the case of VMI. They started taking those grains of rice back in 95, 96 with the court case that forced women in there. And now the bowl's empty and there's nothing we're going to do, we can do about it.
Me sad, son. Makes me sad to think about that. I'm not exactly sure. Terry, are you there? Have you got anything you would like to add? I know there were a couple of things you wanted to talk about, but, son, publicly, I just want to tell you how proud I am of you and of everything you've accomplished, and I'm proud of you as a VMI cadet that you survived that, even though I was giving people money to try to run you off.
Well, thanks, Bob. I appreciate it, and it means a lot. Bob. Thank you.
Chris, your insight is, I really respect your insight. This is the second time I've heard some of your story, and I certainly hold you in esteem, as does your father, obviously. I don't want to shift gears here yet to get into different topics. I just was kind of thinking this is a perfect follow-up to last week's show that we did where we talked about the division and how there's very little way that freedom-loving people in the United States can find any way to really offer up any resistance to the tyranny that we're facing right now. Because the patriots, if you want to call them that, are so divided. And I was thinking about Yuri Bezmenov's lecture on subversion and how this is really right out of that playbook because they have to – one of the first things they do is they want to destabilize the foundational character of the civilization, of the society, and they do that by normalizing immorality, and then they, you know, Hasatan, Satan is a title, and it actually means opposer or accuser, and that's basically what they do. They want to do anything they can to divide. And it also came to mind about, you know, I mentioned last week about Screwtape Letters, the book by C.S. Lewis, where Screwtape, the senior devil, is training Wormwood, the junior devil, in how to mess with the minds of humans and to distract them from what's important and that sort of thing. But one of the things that dawned on me, I remembered C.S. Lewis talking about how it was not very tasty to tempt someone who was easily tempted. It's much more tasty to find somebody who's really worth their salt, who is somebody who's a follower of our Father in heaven and his truth. It's much more tasty to tempt them. And you look at VMI and you look at the discipline and you look at the structure and you look at how boys are made into men basically there. Well, it would be much more tempting and tasty to divide them and to find a way to create a rift in that brotherhood. These are the things that were going through my mind, and this is an important institution that you've been a part of, Chris, and it's very tasty for Satan to think that he can create a rift there, or even destroy that institution. That's what's been going through my mind, gentlemen. So I think this is really an important discussion, but I think people need to recognize what's really going on and the bigger spiritual battle that's going on here, because they're trying to normalize the disrespect of some who would otherwise be taught to be more respectful and to be thoughtful about what's important in life. Any feedback on that, Chris? Does it ring a bell with you?
It does, sir, and you're absolutely right. And more to that thing about respect is that it teaches, one of the other lessons, and I didn't touch on earlier, you brought it up, is about respect. Respecting others and then earning said respect. And, you can't divide people who have a natural respect for others. It's one of the things that does, I've noticed as I've gotten older, is that I have people comment about how respectful I am all the time. And to me, it's a common thing to be respectful to others. And you can't, when you don't teach respect, you don't demand respect or earn respect from others, you can't, like you said, you can be divided quite easily. And to keep people divided makes them easier to control.
And how many people are looking and praying and wishing that the military would come to the rescue today?
Go ahead, sir. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, to that point, you're right, sir. Because that's as a soldier, you take that oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States and against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So, being a civilian, knowing that that's the oath, that yes, you're right. And I think that's another reason probably why they're going so hard with this multiculturalism and this racism theme in the military, is because, probably since around 2001 and on, the military has grown, and you have a lot of veterans out in the community. You have a lot of unity amongst that group. I find myself now, like, anytime I'm in a group, and especially if it's a group of veterans, everybody kind of, everybody has that common background, and it's just almost an instant, I wouldn't say complete, unifying thing, but it is a unifying banner. That is dangerous to the powers that be, to have any group of, right-minded individuals that are united in a cause and a believer in freedom and liberty and so forth. So they have to attack it in the military. And the only way to do it is to divide them. And what easier way to divide them than to tell them everything's racist?
Hey,
Mike,
son, go ahead. I've got a question, son. You mentioned that oath. If I remember correctly, when you graduated from military intelligence at Fort Coochee-Coochee back in 2003, wasn't there some crazy guy who gave the commencement exercise who talked about the oath?
There was. You made a couple colonels very uneasy. But yes, you did. You had your talk was about the oath and upholding it, and living, you know, by that oath as a soldier and an officer.
Yeah, there were some folks beat a hasty retreat out of there after I gave my presentation.
Yep, that was right. Not too many junior officers. Most of the senior officers, you made them extremely uncomfortable with that speech. But
well, I can remember some of your classmates who were graduating. I remember getting emails from them years later, and they remembered the presentation I gave at your graduation ceremony.
Yes, sir. That was a very memorable speech. And I think, you know, for me, you know, I grew up with you, but I think for a lot of people that made a very, very poignant impression upon them.
Well, I hope so, because that was my intent.
And, you know, to be honest, the oath of office, as serious as it is and as I felt it was, that is, I think, more so today has just become something you do with very little meaning behind it for people going in the military now.
Yeah, it's become an obligatory something you have to do just to get from here to there.
Yeah. In the seriousness of that oath, I think has been purposefully downplayed, and so people don't realize the importance of it.
Well, I know one thing, they never did invite me back.
Well, yeah. I mean, wouldn't be the first time, right, Pop?
Terry, you had some things you wanted to cover, sir. I don't want to take too much time that you don't get to cover those.
Well, before we go there, I think we need to take this to an in-game discussion. You guys are war gamers. You've done a lot of that. You've done an excellent job of explaining and exemplifying the mechanics of the attack, the undermining, this subversive agenda that's going on, and VMI is an ideal target, a very tasty target for the satanic globalist. What is your vision, both of you, of the end game here? How do you see this playing out? What are they really trying to ultimately accomplish?
They've already accomplished it, Terry. I think we're just beginning to see the final swirl down the toilet of history for the United States, because as I look around, there are not enough people that are awake to make a difference. Most people are entertained, or they're waiting on some supernova to come over the hill. It's just, there is no plan of action among the people. So I don't see it. I don't see a good outcome without divine intervention. What are your thoughts, son?
I kind of agree with you totally. I mean, you can see it walking around, and now they're walking around identifiable with the mask wearing. You know, I think that is a prime example of what you're saying. The subjugation and the destruction of freedom and liberty that America stands for is you see it walking down the street these days. You see it with the closed businesses. You see it with the not allowing people to go to church. I agree with you. I think we are in the end game as it is.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. My question was as much for the listeners as anything, but you mentioned the mask wearing. That's really part of the topic I wanted to turn to for the last few minutes, for people to start doing their research and understand what's happening. Yesterday, the Federal Wire Service was down globally, and it results, there's so many transactions at an average of about $1,800 per transaction in the wire fed service, that you're talking about over a $1.5 trillion worth of transactions globally that did not happen yesterday. I believe that this is a huge signal for people to recognize that they're testing exactly what it's going to take to bring down the middle class and businesses. This is an attack that's going on, and people need to be aware of it. And the COVID situation has been a distraction for that. The COVID was a distraction for the fact that they removed the reserve requirements from the banks. We've now got something like 35% of all currency in existence today that's either been printed or created in the last year. Now think about it. That represents a dilution of the purchasing power of our currency, a full third or more in 1 year. People are dying after taking the COVID shots. You don't see this on the mainstream media. You need to go dig. You need to go see things like the SGT report. Sean at the SGT report does a really good job. He just did a news update today that the Fed wire service being down, but it also talks about a beautiful 28-year-old healthcare worker who died of a brain aneurysm at age 28, 5 days after the second COVID shot. This is not a vaccine. It is a experimental medical procedure that represents genetic modification. And people need to wake up. It's not a vaccine. So if you're pro-vax, you can be pro-vax, but understand this is not a vaccine. It's an experimental medical procedure that does not meet the criteria of a vaccine. You guys want to make comments regarding that and where we are with that?
Go ahead, son.
Go ahead, Papa.
Well, Terry, that's spot on, and the one thing I do know from my experience, prior experience, is you talked about the test of shutting things down. They always run a few pilot programs to see how it's going to work when they do it, big time, and they shut everything down. So I have no doubt to see how it actually will function and to make sure that they had all their bases covered where they can look at all the cause and effect. And of course, Chris, you said it perfectly. I told someone a couple of months ago, they said, well, when this whole thing goes to hell, how are you going to know who to shoot? And I said, well, just like the old West, all the bad guys will be wearing a mask.
Yep, exactly. and to that point, and Terry, you said it too about doing the research. It's amazing to me the amount of people that don't and that take what their government tells them at face value. And that's one thing you should never do is take anything the government tells you at value.
I've been encountering that for 30 plus years now. I don't know. You can take something from a source document, like a letter from George Washington to John Jay, and you can show it to someone and you can tell them where it can be found, and they will dismiss you and say, no, I want to believe what I learned in school.
Or what my major medical doctor is telling me is the only thing they'll listen
to. Mm-hmm. Well, all you had to do in America to completely control America was you had to take over two things. You had to take over the medical profession and the legal profession. And once you got – and that they've done, because the pharmaceutical companies own the medical schools in America. So they are the ones who have financed and brought this whole thing through. And then, of course, the law schools have turned to cultural Marxism – and the only way you can be a judge is to be a lawyer. So they've all been trained in Marxism. So they've covered the bases. These people are brilliant. And it's real easy to destroy a bunch of people who are only interested in watching cars go around in a circle real fast and who's on reality shows. So we are an entertained people who are about to come to a very violent end.
Well, each one of you got about 1 minute to make your final comments.
Go ahead, son.
Well, I just wanted to capitalize on that. And you said it earlier in the program about being comfortable. We have raised several generations now that prefer being comfortable over anything else. And just like that Roman senator said, as long as the games are on, Rome can collapse around them, and that's exactly what's happening. And they're not paying attention.
The one thing I'm proud of, son, is you, and I think you would probably be willing to tell people that I never gave you the comfortable way out of anything.
No, sir. I've known the hard way my whole life, and I tell you, Pop, I appreciate you doing that every day, because again, like I said, that's life ain't easy, and you've got to make hard, tough choices. And living, especially if you want to live as free as possible, you have to accept the uncomfortable. And I've been taught those lessons time and time again growing up, and I've learned them and all throughout my life, and I appreciate it. I really do.
Well, you honor me, son. I appreciate it. And thanks for coming on and being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, Pop. I enjoyed it as always.
You guys both are awesome. I sure appreciate both of you. Thanks for a great show tonight. And we'll be back next Thursday night with Handling the Truth with the Rebel Man-Man and Tenacity. Chris, you have a great night. Thank you so much. You're a wonderful guest.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. You have a good night as well.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.